extra month. So these are predominantly mature people who have been extremely effective in their work. And I thought, oh God, I'm preaching to the choir. These people will be totally on top of what I'm going to say, but some of them won't, and so I guess I have to kind of tell them what mindfulness is and tell them what happiness and well-being is. And so I asked, I took a poll at the very beginning, put them in gallery view, and I said, raise your hand if you're in one of three groups, people that have little or no familiarity with mindfulness, some familiarity with mindfulness, maybe you've practiced a little bit, and people that have had quite a bit of experience in mindfulness and practice regularly. Third group, two. No, one. Third group was one, practicing regularly. 20% practice have moderate familiarity, and 80% know nothing about it or almost nothing about it. So we're an exceptional group, you know, even in California, but certainly throughout the culture. It's not true that this has become disseminated in the culture entirely yet. Secondly, is there something else? Oh yeah, what I did with them is what I've done with you before, we'll do it in our last class. I did the chopper-gram, but I have a new version of it, a better version, so we'll do that again in our last class. Many of you have done that with me, maybe more than once. So I asked people, again, how many of you know about the Hindu chakra system? That was where two people raised their hand. Can you believe that? Two people out of, and these are really smart people who lived a long time. So I thought you might not want to know that, that there's still work to be done here.
At MIT. That was an MIT class he taught.
We are doing it. The idea is you are spreading. It's amazing how people can go through their whole lives doing what they do, but not really taking full advantage of their mental capacity and not really understanding what makes for enduring satisfaction. You know, it's not something that is generally known in the culture. What's generally known in the culture is if you're not happy, go buy something else. It's called a hedonic treadmill. Buy something else for a little while, you'd be happy, then you adapt to it, you slide back to where you were before. Well, then you got to buy something else. That's what every advertisement says, buy this and you will be happy. And it keeps the engine of commerce running, but it keeps people frustrated because you always lose what you thought you were going to keep. So well-being, as opposed to momentary happiness, has to do with living what you're doing. With living a virtuous, worthwhile life, with investing your energies in things that are really significant and give you lasting satisfaction. They might not be pleasant to do, some of the things we have to do are difficult, but we do them because they're worthwhile to do. But in a nutshell, that's what well-being is. Well-being is how you function, not just how you feel. And that's what I call new 2 hours. But that's not what we're doing today. What we're doing today is we're revisiting for the nth time the idea of what the self is, how we are who we uniquely are, how that develops and some aspects of it. This is an enormous question. We're not going to answer this question now, but I'm going to give you a whole bunch of inputs about this, some of which might not be familiar to you. So where I'm going to start with this is, I mentioned this in the spring, to those of you who are online. At that point, I was taking a course in the adult children of emotionally immature parents, ACEPs. And when I first heard about this course, I thought, oh my God, not another adult children of people who painted their house pink, you know, I mean, give me a break. But I was kind of strong-armed into taking this course, and it turned out to be extremely good. And the moral to the story is that if you were raised by parents that weren't entirely emotionally mature, and perhaps even a little bit narcissistic, then you did not develop a secure sense of self and an accurate sense of self. You develop a sense of self that was able to please or appease them, but required you to put away parts of who you were, or distort parts of who you were, or deny parts of who you were. So, children of ASAPs, they grow up to really not know deeply and securely who they are. They know there's something wrong, and they know that they feel phony some of the time, and they're people pleasers some of the time, but they kind of don't have a secure, accurate sense of who they are, and a feeling of comfort with that. So what I realized is, after I thought about it for a little bit, is that's about everybody. Okay, because nobody was raised by perfect parents, and even if you were, the society gives you messages that cause you to suppress parts of yourself or distort parts of yourself. So this is just an accentuation of the predicament we're all in. So, having thought that, I wrote down a couple of quick notes here about things to remind you of, and then I'm going to show you a partial solution to this. So, first, Sigmund Freud. What did Sigmund Freud say about the self? Freud said there's a conflict between who you what you really want, your biological nature, which he called the id, the you that you're born with. I want this, I don't want that, I laugh and I cry, and I don't think too much about it, I just am a biological being. Well, you can't go through life like that because we're in a social setting. So there's a conflict between your biological needs and the social rules. He called the social rules the superego. And when you internalize that, you get a conscience. But it means you can't be genuinely who you are in terms of your own individual biological nature, because some of those things wouldn't be okay in society. You have to make a compromise. He said it's a conflict. A better way to look at it is it's a compromise. But what he said is, unconsciously, there's always kind of a war going on between what your biology wants. I want to go to sleep now. But you can't. You're in a class. People will laugh at you. I'm hungry now, and that person has the apple, and I'm bigger than she is. You can't just grab the apple. That's illegal, you know? What is the matter with you? There's an attractive person over there. Should I just drag that person into the bushes? You can't do that. So on an unconscious level, there's always this motivation from the id, this biological I want, I need, and then there's this sensory of it. And before it gets to consciousness, it's been changed so it's good enough, so it's not offensive. So what Freud says, that means first, you don't really know who you are, because when it gets to the conscious level, it's already been prettified or distorted. And also, you're boring to yourself because you've already done it once and rehearsed it, and now when it comes out your mouth, it comes out your mouth secondhand. And secondly, everybody else is boring because they're doing the same thing. And there are some few people that have solved this conflict, so that it's not a conflict, it's a confluence. And they're what's called self-actualizing people, according to Maslow. And Maslow said, instead of these people being at war with themselves unconsciously and giving out to the world that which is sanitized, they're who they really are, and they just come out with it. And sometimes they have to apologize. But they're wonderful to be around because they surprise themselves and they surprise everybody else, and everything comes out fresh, not secondhand. So that's what Freud said, and Maslow added to that. Janine.
Looks like the table might collapse. I'm worried you're going to fall
over. Okay. Oh, because it's not.
Yeah, it's not locked.
Okay, well, thank you. Let's see if this one's locked too. So that's what Freud said. He said, Our conscious sense of self is not an accurate or full representation of who we really are. Now, we're more than our biological needs. But that's what Freud was talking about, okay? Then Carl Rogers, in the 1950s, the 1960s, and we know about this, so I'm going to go over this stuff pretty quickly. It's just a reminder for almost everybody. Rogers said there's two ways to raise your kids. The way we were raised and the right way. Okay? And he said the way we were raised is our parents controlled us by giving us love when we did what they wanted and withdrawing love when we did what they didn't want. And since kids need the love and protection of their parents, we learned to do what they wanted and not to do what they didn't want. So we learn that sometimes we're worthy of love and sometimes we're not. And we better get rid of the stuff that is not worthy of love so that we can have the love and protection we need. Rogers called this developing conditions of worth. Sometimes we are worthy and sometimes we're not worthy. There are conditions for our worthiness. And also it brings in to us an idea that sometimes we're good and sometimes we're bad. And we better get rid of the bad so that we don't get in trouble with our parents and then get in trouble with society. So we gotta do something with these aspects of ourselves. For example, anger. Young men, good children don't get angry and don't say those things to their parents. Young lady, you're happy. It's a beautiful day. We're making a party for you. Why are you crying? You're not sad. You're happy. You know? So we get these distorted messages or these messages when you're in the store and the kid says, I want that. And, no, you don't want that. If you misbehave like that, we'll have to leave the store. You won't get anything. So we learn that natural parts of who we are, certain aspects of our nature, especially difficult feelings like anger and sadness, which are there for really good reasons and should be acknowledged and understood and learned from, instead, we have to get rid of them. We have to put them somewhere. And we do. Where do we put them? Underneath the rug. We make them unconscious. So now, instead of a unified self, we have a split self between conscious good me and unconscious bad me. And for the rest of our lives, we walk around on some level afraid that bad me is going to jump out at the wrong time, and sometimes it does. How could I have said that? How could I be feeling this way? So we're surprised by ourselves sometimes, and we offend ourselves or other people sometimes. Good. All right, so if we were raised not with this withdrawal of love if we were raised to not be controlled by giving us love or telling us we're bad and withdrawing love, if we were raised by whatever we brought up, the parents acknowledged it and said, "Oh, I see that you're angry. How does it feel? Do you remember when it started? Where is it in your body? What is it telling you to do?" You know, we got familiar with all these feelings and we got to include them in who we are. Then we would grow up with all our feelings conscious, and we would use all these feelings the way that they should be used, because they're for a reason. Sadness is about lack or loss. Anger is about threat. And you need to have those feelings in order to succeed in life. You know, they're built into us for a good reason. So Rogers said, what you want to do about your kids, and what you want to do about everybody, is affirm the person, correct the behavior. It's not that you let your kid do lousy stuff. You say, I understand, dear, that you're angry and that you want to do this thing, but if you do this thing, this will be the consequence. If you do this better thing, this will be the consequence. That makes what's called an instrumentally competent kid. A kid that makes decisions that are good decisions, that help, that build the life. So, I didn't know I was going to go here, but Julian Rotter in the 1950s said that there are two ways to kind of look at the world. just weaving a lot of stuff together, right? He said, he talked about locus of control, L-O-C-U-S of control. And he said there are two loci of control. Most people have what's called an external locus of control. That is, the control is outside them. And if a person with an external locus of control wakes up in the morning and says, what do I have to do today? And then goes through the day fielding the demands. And if we haven't dropped the ball when we go to bed, we go, thank God, I didn't screw up today. And so it's the control is outside and you're just reacting to it. People with an internal locus of control, they get up in the morning saying, what have I created for my life today? And they go through their day, even when there are problems, they don't look at them as problems. They say, these are challenges that will bring out my best, that will make me more creative, that will strengthen me. When they go to bed at night, they say, what a beautiful job I did. Can't wait for tomorrow. What's the difference? People with an internal locus of control realize that the choices they make determine their life. And even when stuff comes from outside, the choices they make determine how they're going to deal with it. So they're making choices that make their life. That's a person that has been affirmed in all the aspects of themselves when they were growing up. So they realized that their parents told them, look, you got to make good choices. If you choose this, that'll be the consequence. If you choose that, that'll be the consequence. I understand you're angry. But if you throw a temper tantrum, then the consequence will be we have to leave the party. If you're angry and instead you tell me what it is that you would like to be changed, maybe we can get that changed. So it's a different choice. So the kid learns to make positive productive choices. And that translates into internal locus of control. I hope that made sense. Did it so far? So what we're saying is we don't have to be split up, but most of us walk through our lives really afraid that the bad stuff that's unconscious is gonna surface.
Spence.
And so we spend a lot of time keeping the bad stuff locked up. Most of the neurosis can be looked at as a self-reflective, self-defeating behavior. That is, instead of looking at you, the neurotic is thinking, am I making a good impression? So they have rear view mirrors on. They're always looking at themselves. And they're always afraid that they're not doing what they should be doing. You know, so they're spending all this remarkable energy just in adjudicating what comes out. Most of their energy is spent in self-concern rather than in concern for what they're doing or other people. That's neurosis. I keep trying to put the paper, you know, lick my thumb to get paper. Leon.
So how do you spell Julian's last name?
Say again?
Julian.
Roger. R-O-T-T-E-R. R-O-T-T-E-R.
Rotter. Thank you.
A terrible last name, but it is.
Thank you.
Well, I just noticed that I promised you last week that I would tell you more of the benefits of mindfulness. There's no time for that. I'll do it next week. One of the pieces of paper that I skipped over. All right, so who else has talked about this? Problem with not knowing who you are, trusting who you are, and being your full genuine self. Carl Jung, of course. Remember what Jung said? Jung said we can make, I didn't make the diagram here, but you can make a diagram of a moon, okay? And let's say it's a crescent moon. There's a part that's illuminated, and then the rest of it is in shadow. That's actually not the right diagram. The right diagram is there's a crescent part that's illuminated. There's a middle part. And then there's a shadow part at the other side. So shadow, self, and persona. So what Jung said is, the self is who we really are, the middle part. But the self is only part of how we understand ourselves and how other people understand us. Some stuff we put in the shadow, stuff that we don't accept about ourselves, we stick unconscious, just like Freud said. Just like Roger said also. So there's a significant amount of shadow material. That is, stuff that we're not aware of, that we were aware of, that we make ourselves unaware of because it's too threatening to be aware of that. Some of that's social stuff, some of it's biological stuff, but we all walk around with a highly significant shadow. By the way, he also said that what we do with the shadow is, instead of acknowledging it in ourselves, we see it in other people, and we get mad at them. That person is so selfish. That person is so this. That person is so that. That's your own shadow material being activated by that other person, and then you put it on them. It's called projection, right? And he said, if you want to save the world, own your projections. Take them back. Realize that you're objecting to that person for the very same reason you're objecting to yourself. And you better make peace with yourself and that person. That's what Jung said about the shadow. He also said that there's another ingenuine aspect to who we are. We call that the persona. Now, the persona is supposed to be a thin veil that we wear that enables us to get along with other people in an expeditious way. When you're walking down the street, when you meet a friend, or you're walking by somebody that you know, and they say, "Hi, how are you?" You don't tell them the truth. They don't have an hour. They don't want to hear the drama. You know, they just want to say, you say, "Fine." You say, "How are you?" "Fine." You know, and that's the persona. It should be a thin social lubrication. Hope I didn't say anything wrong there. What happens to many people is the persona becomes very thick. In order to make a good impression on other people, we start to put on a false face. We start to be people pleasers. We start to be people that we know will get approval, or we think will get approval from them. The problem with the persona is not only does it's a mask, not only does it face outward, it faces inward. We lose touch with the self that we genuinely are, because the mask is too thick. So he said that's a common problem, is that we have lost touch with our genuine self because we're too busy constructing this phony self. So back to Carl Rogers. I was just going to read a little bit of the article that I gave you today out, but I had copies of it, and I thought, no, I want them to have this. I don't know if you want to read it or not, but it's a short article and it is remarkable. I'm going to read you just some of the words at the very end of it, okay? So first of all, the title of it is What It Means to Become a Person, and I'm on the very last page. So it's also the first page. I Xeroxed it in a... I copied it in a way that I put two pages on one page. So if you see page 114, that's where we are. So let's see if you can... okay, you can read it and I will read it out loud. So he's quoting someone in therapy. And this is about therapy, but it's also about personal growth. And he's quoting someone in therapy. "You know, it seems as if all the energy that went into holding the arbitrary pattern together was quite unnecessary, a waste." So this arbitrary pattern is the persona. It's the pattern of people-pleasingness. It's the pattern of trying to be who you think you should be. So she's saying it's a waste. "You think you have to make the pattern yourself, but there are so many pieces, and it's so hard to see where they fit. Sometimes you put them in the wrong place, and the more pieces misfitted, the more effort it takes to hold them in place. Until at last you are so tired that even the awful confusion of not knowing who you are is better than holding on any longer." This is a great line. "Then you discover that left to themselves, the jumbled pieces fall quite naturally into their own places, and a living pattern emerges without any effort at all on your part. You just accept every aspect of yourself and it all falls together. Your job is just to discover it, and in the course of that, you will find yourself in your own place. You must even let your own experience tell you its own meaning, The minute you tell it what it means, you are at war with yourself. You're denying your own experience. Let me see if I can take her poetic expression and translate it into the meaning it has for me. I believe she is saying that to be herself means to find the pattern, the underlying order, which exists in the ceaselessly changing flow of her experience. Rather than trying to hold her experience into the form of a mask, or to make it be a form or structure that it is not, being herself means to discover the unity and harmony which exists in her own actual feelings and reactions. It means that the real self is something which is comfortably discovered in one's experiences, not something imposed on it. Through giving excerpts from the statements of these clients, I have been trying to suggest that what happens in the warmth and understanding of a facilitating relationship with a therapist, or with a facilitating relationship with yourself, or with a friend. It seems that gradually, painfully, the individual explores what is behind the masks he presents to the world, and even behind the masks with which he has been deceiving himself. Deeply and often vividly, he experiences the various elements of himself which have been hidden within. Thus, to an increasing degree, he becomes himself. Not a facade of conformity to others, not a cynical denial of all feeling, or a front of intellectual rationality, but rather a living, breathing, feeling, fluctuating process. In short, he becomes a person. Couldn't have said it as well myself. So if you wanted to boil that down into one statement, in order to be who you are fully and genuinely, you have to feel all your feelings. You just have to let yourself feel everything you feel and understand that it all makes sense at some level and it all will make sense. But you have to be brave enough to say how I really feel is, what I really think is, at least yourself. Tara Brach calls this radical self-acceptance, right? She says, whatever comes up, you kind of say, yeah, that's me too. Not so easy. Okay, so what do we do about all this? I want to show you something that is from the ASEPS course I took. Lindsay Gibson, the woman who ran the course, wrote a Bill of Rights for ASEPS, for Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, which I think is a Bill of Rights for all of us. So I'm going to put it up on the screen. Now everybody's looking down at their feet going, all right, shoes, you know.
If your feet are, by the way, if unconsciously or semi-consciously you're wearing clothes that irritate you, you're going to get irritated. All right, so back to this. Your feet are growing and you're experiencing symptoms. You're not, something is wrong in your life, and you go to the shrink. And the shrink says, oh, easy, take this pill, we will shrink your feet back so they fit your shoes. That's what they call shrinks, right? So forgive me, any former psychiatrist here. If you go to an expand, like the people that I hang out with, they will say, oh, I see, your feet are growing too large for your shoes. Let's get you a better, larger pair of shoes. That means a different life. That means the problem is not in you, it's in the constraints of your life or the way you're looking at your life. And we need to have you look more accurately at your life, and especially we need to have you change the things that are constraining you, that are paining you. The pain is valuable. They're flags, they're signals saying, grow here. Where your symptoms are is where the growth needs to happen. Symptoms are super valuable. You don't want to erase them. You want to transform them. So that's the first of her overall treatment goals. If you're treating yourself, these are your goals. Second, the true self exists. I guess I got to say something about that. Okay. Oftentimes, when you ask people to look here in therapy, they say, you say, what's there? And they say, I don't feel anything there. Nothing. And then you say, look more deeply. And they say, it's like a black hole. It's like an infinitely deep hole. That's good, that's progress. And then they say, after more work, they say, it feels numb. And then, after more work, they say, it feels bad. There are bad feelings that are coming out of here. And that's really good. Because after a while, they say, there are a lot of feelings coming out of here. And gradually, they reclaim the self, the core of who they are, the essence of who they are. And people that have a strong sense of self, when something happens, they go here. They say, does this resonate with me? Is this okay? Is this genuine in me? Or is this something that is not resonant with here? They have a reference point. But people without a strong sense of self don't have a reference point. At the risk of being who I really am, when I was in college last year, I remember a full session that we had, and I remember saying, I am 10 roles arranged around a hollow core. I can play 10 roles perfectly arranged around a hollow core. And I really believed it. It was really true. I didn't have a sense of self. I just had an ability to fake it in various ways. And some of you relate to that extremely well, unless if you're only partially. But. All right, so what's the next one? Reconnect your inner world, the smallest feeling, the quickly dismissed thought. When you're meditating or when you're just sensitive to yourself, thoughts will flit across your mind faster than you can say them. And a lot of them won't be thoughts that you want to have. You want to have those thoughts. They say something. They may not be, they may be crude, but they tell you something about what you need. So, and smallest feeling, you know, we go emotional, I just taught a class in emotional intelligence. This is bothering me, I'll pick it up. Who did it? Okay, we're good. Okay. That's called obsessive compulsive disorder. you gotta put on a mask, okay? And you also gotta sign in. And it's good to see you, I can. But put on a mask, yeah. Or if you don't have one, go get one. But yeah, you need one. Okay, all right, so. It'll come back. feelings, emotional intelligence. Thank you, that was important. I just taught a class in emotional intelligence to my positive psychology people, which always, when I teach it early in the semester, it hooks them in, because everybody wants to know about feelings. Most of us have been schooled out of feeling our feelings. That is, the rewards and punishments from society are to use your head, not to get hijacked by what's going on in here. More so for males than females. Females, at least to some degree, are allowed to actually have feelings. But males are discouraged majorly from having feelings because they get in the way. You just want to use your head. You don't want to ignore what you're feeling. It's a weakness. So what happens for everybody, to some degree, and for a lot of people to an enormous degree, is you lose consciousness of your feelings, period. You don't have feelings. You only have feelings. Almost everybody believes that feelings happen occasionally. Occasionally, you get really angry and you say something. Occasionally, you get really sad and you cry. Occasionally, you get really happy and you laugh. But most of the time, you're too busy. You don't have feelings. They have feelings, you know, every once in a while when the feelings are big. It's not true. Feelings are your organism at every moment, the functioning of your organism, and it's constantly changing in regard to the environment you're in and the things that are on your mind, so your feelings are constantly permuting. And people who are very emotionally in touch feel their feelings all the time, and their feelings give them an added dimension in the world, a kind of a depth in the world as they move through the world. Artists tend to be good at this, at least some of the time. They're more in touch with the emotional process.
You speak or you God.
Say again?
You speak or you God.
Oh, that's God? All right.
It's a hurting.
This is what it is.
Can you do something about that?
Right.
You speak or you God, I think you're really
good. Okay. Is it back on?
Yeah.
If this went back on now, or would you be doing your work easily?
Yes.
Okay, good. It feels. The process of becoming more emotionally intelligent is a process of recovering the ability to feel moment by moment, or at least more of the time. When you first start meditating, most people, when they first start meditating, they go to sleep, they space out, and they don't have any content. And then after a little more practice, they start to hear their own thoughts. And for a long while, the thoughts are predominant. The thoughts are really loud, and you go, oh my God, I can't believe how much voice there is in my head. So the focus is on the head. But after a while, what happens is the thoughts become a little more boring and repetitive, and you pay a little less attention to them, because mostly it's a bunch of nonsense up there, you heard it before. And then you have more time, more openness to the emotional process, and it starts to emerge. And then what happens is the emotions become much more powerful and important than the thought process, which is seen as just the tip of the emotional process. It's not that the thoughts are different than the emotions. They're a representation of the entire organism as it is adapting to life moment to moment. But the feelings, the stuff here that colors your world, that is an energy, an emanation, that stuff, a read on the whole organism, that stuff becomes much more evident as you progress in meditation. And also as you just become more emotionally intelligent. So emotional intelligence, I didn't always go here, but I'll give you a four-question emotional intelligence quiz. By the way, there are a whole bunch of different emotional intelligence quizzes that people use, none of which are the standard quiz. They haven't been around long enough to be the standard. But here's my amalgam of all of them. It's really superior to any of them, I think. So here's my four-question quiz for you. Do you know how you're feeling right now? All right, take the quiz. Do you know know how you're feeling right now. I'll give you 10 seconds to find your feelings.
Regaining genuine sense of self. Your body tells you stuff. Your body is you. It's not, your body is not walking your head around. Your body is your organism. So when your body, when your stomach is upset, it's telling you something. It's either you ate something bad or you've stomached something bad. Reclaim your self-value, equal importance. Kids that, we walk around, many of us, feeling that we're not, we have to sacrifice ourselves, that we're not really worthy of being taken care of. We need to simply forget about ourselves and take care of other people. And that we somehow, something's wrong with us. Because there's several things conflated in there. So you have equal importance to other people. Doesn't mean that you are more important than they are, but it doesn't mean that you have to suppress your needs for their needs. What I tell people all the time, it's real hard, especially for half of us, is if you, to be a conscious person, you need to do two things. You need to take care of other people, and you need to take care of yourself. If you don't take care of yourself, it diminishes your ability to take care of other people. You really have to, there are two charges you have. You have to make sure you're okay, and you have to make sure the people that you care about are okay. But if you don't, if you sacrifice yourself, then what are you telling the people? What are you telling your kids when you sacrifice yourself over and over again for your kids? You're telling your kids, when you grow up, sacrifice yourself for your kids. Nobody ever gets happy because everybody's deferring satisfaction to the next generation. Sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself, but if you make a habit out of that, you're going to come up, unless you're a saint, you're going to come up with resentment. After a while, you're going to say, wait a minute. I had a client, a woman who came to me in her mid-70s, who said, I have been a wonderful mother, wife, teacher, performer. I've been all these things. What I want to know is who I am. I got lost a long, long, long time ago in these roles. And the work we did for about 10 years was she found out who she was, and she's a pretty remarkable person. So you really need to take care of yourself as well as other people. Freedom to think and feel anything. Freedom to think and feel anything. That's really important. You can't say to yourself, I can't think that. That's wrong. That's bad. I can't feel that. Freedom to think and feel anything. Take your feelings and needs seriously. Take your feelings and needs seriously. And work towards your desired outcomes. Be active on your own behalf. That is, you got to do it for yourself. You can do this for you. Even if you come into therapy, you have to do the work. Because the therapist can't do it for you. Can't give you. There's no pill that can do it. There's no therapeutic treatment that can do it for you. You have to be the one that does it. The therapist just helps that process, encourages that process. So I thought you might want to see that. That's not just for ACEPs, it's for all of us. Okay, so, yeah. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to show, hey, Ray.
Yeah. The, you know, 50% of our time we do intention. And one way to deal with that is to take a deep breath. Every time we seek the out things, take a deep breath and relax. And, you know, the Chinese have said it better.
Yeah, so that's what he—that's actually his book. What Abraham just said is we can be either tense or relaxed 80% of the time, or some significant percentage we're tense. Tension is who you think you should be. Relaxation is who you really are.
Yeah.
And there's a Chinese quote, a quote from some Chinese philosopher. Okay, so now what I want to do is I want to expand our, we made the point that I wanted to make over and over again. Now I want to broaden the definition, I want to broaden the investigation of what the self is and where it comes from. I want to go to a different level. And this we'll do this through a video, which is a 10-minute video. We'll talk about it, and then when we come back in a couple of weeks, not next week because Dave's going to be here, but in a couple of weeks, then we'll go further into this investigation of why we have a self, why we feel like I'm here and you're there. Why does that come about? Well, there are various answers to that, and they're conflicting. But you'll see. So what you can do to help me is, if you know how to do this, pull the red drapes to the level of the door. Don't pull them over past the door, but pull them to, so we have, like that. And just grab it. That's the best way. But I can, just so it's not so it covers the door. When you get, just to where the door is open, you need to have the air coming in. So Ken, you don't need the screen, you just need the red thing. And there is, you can either pull it or there is actually a, wait, you got that one? Yeah, that'll be it. You just need to see this.
Hang on.
have any idea what this would be? We just wanted to play with it. Oh, I didn't play the press video. Yeah, I'm going to restart it, yeah, because it worked before, so we're going to do that. Okay.
Will say, you know, it's just your duty, you know? And so for them, it's differentiate ourselves from others endlessly. We have a model of self where the self is kind of like an avocado, right? When we have a pit inside of us, the pit is our self, our essence, our identity. It is the thing to which we must above all be true. And of course, very importantly, we see that pit as unique. So that everything we do, if we want to show, to reflect that pit, to reflect that self, and we want it to be unique. In Asia, people frequently have a flexi self. So it's a different kind of self. It is a self that's oriented more to duty than to rights, for instance. And very importantly, it does not have a cultural mandate to be different and to be unique. So if you ask, are they individuals? Of course they're individuals. Are they different? Of course they are different. But of course, for them, it's like, well, of course I'm different. Why would I make a big deal of that, right? The difference is, how much significance do we attach to that difference? In other words, do we think it's very important to differentiate ourselves from others? So one of the ways that we do that, of course, is choice. Choice in the West is very, very important. Everyone is always making choices. And honestly, a lot of those choices make us a little anxious. If you do a study where you are just sitting in an empty room and you're making a choice and you come from a more individualistic culture, you actually show signs of a little anxiety. Every little choice that you make, even in private, because it's defining who you are, is a little loaded. They feel like they just choose. It doesn't have this overlay. And that's one of the reasons they feel that actually we are less free than they are. So they think that we are the ones who are kind of in this prison where, like I say, every moment we must define ourselves. Well, isn't that awful, right? And of course, the way that we live, we feel that we want to be freely electing to live the way that we live, right? And so even when we're doing things like taking care of the elderly, for example, we want to feel that it's an extension of our great love and the nature of our being to be able to take care of the elderly. Well, the other day I was having dinner with somebody who said, I just don't feel that, and it's just very, very hard. So somebody from a more flexi self or interdependent culture would say, it's just your duty, And so for them, it's like, they have their elderly parent, they just go take care of the elderly parent because that's their duty. For them, this is really liberating. You just go do it, and you don't expect there to, to express yourself. This is what people do. From their point of view, we have made things very, very hard for ourselves to demand that, that everything should be an expression of our inner nature.
We often like to think that the way to become a good person is to look within, find one's true self, the sort of natural self that we have. And once you've found that self, that natural thing that you are, the goal is to be sincere and authentic to that true self. So if we stick to what we naturally are meant to be, the gifts that we're naturally endowed with, that's how we can be a sincere, authentic person. Now, a lot of our Chinese philosophers would say that sounds good, but is on the contrary, extremely restraining and constraining to what we could do. The fact is, if we're messy creatures, as many of them would say, what we perhaps are in our daily lives are simply people whose emotions are being pulled out all the time by people we encounter, interactions we have. And over time, those responses fall into kind of ruts and patterns that can just be repeated endlessly. So someone does something, it makes me angry, and not even because of what they immediately did, but because for some reason it brings back, say, someone from my childhood coming at me. And I just have a patterned response to a certain action being done in a certain way by anyone that brings up a certain response. So if they're onto something in this, and I might have lots of psychological experiments show that they really are, then what that means, if you try to look within and find your true self, this thing you think you naturally are, what you're probably finding are just a bunch of patterns you fall into, many of which could potentially be dangerous for you, for those around you. And if that's the goal, you should be trying to break those patterns, alter those patterns, change the way you interact in the world. And if you're simply saying, I should be who I naturally am meant to be, well, what you're probably doing is simply continuing to follow a bunch of patterns, probably disruptive to yourself, almost assuredly disruptive to folks around you. The idea is it's constant work, working through these patterns we're falling into, altering these patterns, breaking these patterns, creating different patterns, and it's an endless work of every situation, from the very mundane to the very, very large scale, of constantly trying to shift these patterns for the better. And the vision is that, and really only that, is what the good life is. The good life is a world in which as many of us as possible, ideally everyone, is flourishing. And you'll never get there, but it's a lifelong process of ever trying to create worlds within which we can flourish.
There's this notion in Buddhist psychology of egolessness or no self. And most people misinterpret that, as Freud actually did. Most people misinterpret it to think that, oh, Buddhism is saying we don't need the ego at all, or we don't need the self at all. Like, get. And I think that's wrong. Obviously, we need our egos. A good friend of mine, Robert Thurman, who's a professor of Buddhism at Columbia, professor of religion at Columbia, he had a Mongolian teacher in the 1960s who used to say to him about this topic of egolessness or selflessness, it's not that you're not real. Of course you're real. You know, you have a self. But people like you, secular people who don't really understand, think that they are really real. And what Buddhism is teaching is that that belief in your own really realness is misguided. We take ourselves more seriously than we need to. The self is not as fixed as we would like to think. The ego is born out of fear and isolation. You know, it comes into being when self-consciousness first starts to come, when you're 2 or 3 years old, you know, and you start to realize, oh, I'm like, there's a person in here, and you're kind of like trying to make sense of everything, who you are, who are those parents there. You know, the ego is a way of organizing oneself, and it comes from the intellect as the mind starts to click in. For many people, it stays in a kind of immature place where our thinking mind, our intellect, is defining for ourselves who we are, either taking all the negative feedback, like I'm not good enough, and the ego fastens onto all the negativity, or the positive, the affirmation, like, oh, I'm really something, you know? And the ego likes certainty, it likes security, it likes repetition. And so it's always reinforcing its own vision of itself. And that starts to restrict us, to confine us, to make us think that we know ourselves better than we actually do.
One of the problems we have in discussing consciousness scientifically is that consciousness is irreducibly subjective. Consciousness is what it's like to be you. If there's an experiential, internal, qualitative dimension to any physical system, then that is consciousness. And we can't reduce the experiential side to talk of information processing and neurotransmitters and states of the brain in our case, because, and people want to do this. Someone like Francis Crick said famously, you're nothing but a pack of neurons. And that misses the fact that half of the reality we're talking about is the qualitative experiential side. So when you're trying to study human consciousness, for instance, by looking at states of the brain, all you can do is correlate experiential changes with changes in brain states. But no matter how tight these correlations become, that never gives you license to throw out the first person experiential side. That'd be analogous to saying that if you just flip the coin long enough, you would realize it had only one side. And now it's true you can be committed to talking about just one side. You can say that heads being up is just a case of tails being down.
but that doesn't actually reduce one side of reality to the other. I'm not arguing that consciousness is a reality beyond science or beyond the brain, or that it floats free of the brain and death. I'm not making any spooky claims about its metaphysics. What I am saying, however, is that the self is an illusion, the sense of being an ego, an I, a thinker of thoughts in addition to the thoughts, an experiencer in addition to the experience, that the sense that we all have of riding around inside our heads as a kind of a passenger in the vehicle of the body, that's where most people start when they think about any of these questions. But most people don't feel identical to their bodies. They feel like they have bodies. They feel like they're inside the body. And most people feel like they're inside their heads. Now that sense of being a subject, a locus of consciousness inside the head, is an illusion. That is, it makes no neuroanatomical sense. There's no place in the brain for your ego to be hiding. We know that everything you experience, your conscious emotions and thoughts and moods and the impulses that initiate behavior, all of these things are delivered by myriad different processes in the brain that are spread out over the whole of the brain, that they can be independently erupted. We have a changing system. We are a process. And there's not one unitary self that's carried through from one moment to the next, unchanging. And yet we feel that we have this self. It's just this center of experience.
Get smarter, faster, new videos every week from the world's biggest thinkers.
Collectivist cultures and in individualist cultures. We feel that we need to make choices about everything all the time, that we're individually, we exist individually. We exist independently of other people, whereas in collectivist cultures, people exist interdependently. And there's more that is done by custom and tradition, and there's less choice that has to be made, and that's actually liberating, is what you said. Then Michael P., I didn't get his last name either, I'm too busy scribbling down other notes, so he said, the true self is, there isn't, we think we have a true self, but it's actually a bunch of learned patterns. And what we need to do is keep looking at these patterns and shifting them to be healthier patterns, and that's a lifelong process. So the self, there's no real true self, there's just patterns that we discover that we need to adjust so that they work better. We learn these patterns when we were young. And then Mark Epstein said, the Buddhists say that there's no self, egolessness. We're going to talk about that a bunch in 2 weeks. And then I got my friend Joe Bobro, the Zen master psychoanalyst, is coming in about a month, and he'll have a lot to say about anatta, about egolessness. So Mark Epstein said, the self is not as fixed as we would like to think it is. It's not as constant as we would like to think it is. And that our ego comes with our thinking mind, with our ability, with our development of self-consciousness. We develop this idea of who we are. And we'll talk a bunch more about that. And then Sam Harris said, we have a qualitative experience of being a person. It's different than what our brain, it's more than what our brain is doing. And this idea we have of a constant self is illusion. It's not true. The brain is doing a whole bunch of different things, sometimes independently of one of the other. And somehow we have a mistaken notion that there's a constancy when there's a fluctuation in how the brain is dealing with life. So right now, there's a lot of muddy water, there's a lot of kind of semi-contradictory things sitting there. I don't think it all makes sense. I will, I really will. That'll be in 2 weeks. I hope that you got thoroughly confused this morning and that it provoked you to, for yourself, consider who the heck you are. And be more, look more acceptingly at who you are and be more inclusive of what you find. Because it all fits together. Carl Rogers said it does, okay? See you next week.